Thank you very much to Catherine and Marcus for this invitation. I'd like to talk about the evolving economic and monetary policy of the EU after the Pringle case. But to do that, I first of all need to put the wider Eurozone crisis into some sort of economic policy context. So let's first of all consider what the short-term and long-term causes of the Eurozone crisis are. Why are we in this position in the first place? It's partly an economic issue, but it's also a legal issue. So in the short term, obviously, there's a shock in the world economy caused by the global financial crisis, which has nothing at all to do with the European Union. It begins in New York and London. So essentially, it's a feature of the common market, common law, neoliberal economies, not at all the mainstream mainland European ones. But of course, the impact of the crisis in the British and American financial markets then ripples out to other countries. And so the Eurozone states are then hit by large public sector deficits, which are caused by just the economic recession, just the crash. Falling tax revenues, rising social security expenditure are inevitably going to happen when there's an economic recession like this. And this is the most severe one there has been for arguably half a century or more, maybe 100 years. Then, of course, the risks incurred by banks, which have been overlending in the residential property sector and other sectors, are transferred to government. So what begins as private sector debt becomes public sector debt, and therefore there are public sector deficits. All this happens after 2008. But in addition, the short-term factors include the delayed response of the ECB to the debt crisis. It could have done what it has been doing since 2011 much sooner, but that would have solved a lot of these problems. And also, I come back to this, the skewed focus of the Memoranda of Understandings on social policy. Now, long-term, the causes of the crisis are to do with the legal design of the euro itself. Asymmetry was built in, and also rigidity was built into the design of the single currency after the Maastricht Treaty. Essentially, the ECB's single interest rate and uniform inflation target couldn't deal with some significant cross-national differences. Now, this, of course, you could argue is an inevitable feature of a single currency union, but I don't think that's the case. The particular design of EMU was deficient. So what happened was, at post-2000, there was a kind of divergence or asymmetry which triggered the crisis for the peripheral debtor states. Their economic model was fundamentally different from that in the core states. And now, of course, this is being described as a failure on the part of the indebted states. They weren't running their economies properly. But within the single currency zone, everything evens out. So really, in a sense, what was happening was that the core states were exporting their unemployment and inflation to the periphery. We can see that by just looking at some very well-known figures now, but essentially what was going on in the 2000s was, first of all, we didn't see public sector deficits in the Eurozone states, only with one exception, right, Greece. So in Greece there was concealment of public sector deficits with the help of useful agents like Goldman Sachs and other private sector bodies. So Greece is a special case. Greece is unique in a sense within this story. But of course, in some of the now indebted states, there were public sector surpluses. That's the case in Spain, that's the case in Portugal, and their surpluses were greater than the surplus in Germany. Now, also, what was going on in the 2000s was that the peripheral states, the now indebted states, were growing much more quickly. Their economies were growing much more quickly than those in the northern German-influenced core. So growth in real GDP in Germany was comparatively low in this period, although higher in Austria and the Netherlands. Very, very high growth in real GDP. Economies are growing faster in the peripheral states like Ireland, like Greece, and like Spain. However, the consequence partly of that was that unit labour costs, right, nominal wages, but taking into account productivity and inflation, unit labour costs, not just nominal wages, but unit labour costs are growing very, very slowly indeed in Germany, but much faster elsewhere, including very large growths in unit labour costs. And this implies divergence and asymmetry, and of course differential inflation rates then have an impact on the plausibility of a single interest rate policy. But the basic problem here is that the ECB's single interest rate policy and standard inflation target inevitably implied reduced growth and depressed wage growth in particular, and income growth in some states and faster growth in others because of the way these economies were set up. Essentially, the problem only emerges after 2000. In the 1990s, when the Eurozone states are preparing for the introduction of the single currency, there's a high degree of convergence in wage growth. This convergence stops after the single currency is actually introduced around about 2000. That's when wage rate, wage growth diverges between the North and the South. And this is essentially because prior to 2000, there's a national central bank in place in each country which is disciplining wage growth and is able to tailor its own interest rate policies to local conditions. After 2000, ironically, with a single interest rate policy of the ECB, it's not possible to tailor the central bank's intervention to particular country conditions. And the discipline which had previously been imposed on some states on the labour market was lost. This is the argument of Rachel Johnston and Bob Hanke in their paper in 2009, against the background of the hard ECB constraint imposed by the 2% inflation target. After 2000, Germany is structurally forced to maintain low inflation while others inflate. The fundamental divergences between the economies are reflected then in differential wage growth. Now, what's also happening, of course, is not just a question of differential economic models, it's also a question of different ways of regulating wages in the different member states. So, for example, in the northern member states, influenced by the German model, wage growth is deliberately repressed by law. So, for example, a good example is Belgium, which actually has a hard wage target for all sectors, and similar policies of coordinated bargaining were pursued in a number of other so-called northern member states during this period. Now, the effect of this hard wage constraint in countries like Belgium, like Finland, to some degree Germany, the effect is that the constraint that the private sector is under, the private sector is competing in an international market, so there's a wage constraint there, but this constraint is also transferred to the public sector in countries with a hard wage constraint across all sectors. So this, of course, is very important for dampening down wage growth. Now, we don't really have a single European labour market. We definitely don't have a uniform labour law across the member states. We have very, very different forms of wage coordination by law across the member states. There are states with high wage moderation. There's institutional pressure to keep wage increases low or to link them to productivity or maybe to get them below productivity. So productivity is rising faster than wage growth. Unit labour costs go down, even if nominal wages are very high in some of these countries. Nominal wages are much higher in Germany and Austria than they are in Greece, for example. But productivity is below the increase in the wage level in these northern states. That's partly because labour laws in the northern member states put this pressure on wages through solidaristic, coordinated wage bargaining. This isn't deregulation, it's highly regulated, but it's coordinated wage bargaining. We see much weaker sectoral coordinated wage bargaining in the southern states, and that's why we see wage inflation in those states. Now, of course, when the crisis hits, because of the structure again of the single currency, it's not possible for member states facing a fiscal deficit to devalue their currency and use that as a way out of the economic recession, exactly as the UK has been doing since 2008. So the UK has done a number of things. They've allowed the pound to devalue. In addition, what's happened in the UK is so-called macroeconomic stabilisers have been used by the Bank of England and also by the Treasury to some degree, quantitative easing, interest rate policy has been modulated. None of these things are possible for Eurozone states because these things are all now set centrally in effect by the ECB. So of course then the focus must be on the labour market where there is no uniform rule but individual member states can adjust their labour law rules to reflect their particular economic condition. They can't adjust anything else. So that's why the focus is on so-called internal devaluation. Unit wage costs must fall. How is that to be brought about? By cuts in the welfare state, cuts in labour law protection, labour law deregulation and privatisation and deregulation more generally. Now, of course, this policy is then put into place, is locked in at central level through the system of macroeconomic surveillance and monitoring, the Europe 2020 process, the six-pack and the fiscal treaty, or the TCSG, all implement this basic policy, which is in a memorandum of understandings. They embed it at central level. The Troika begins by imposing changes to domestic welfare state and labour law systems, but this is no longer just the activity of the Troika. It's now embedded in the wider macroeconomic surveillance structure, some of which is part of EU law, some of which, as we've heard, is to one side of EU law. Now, the effects of austerity in, for example, Greece have been extreme, and this involves decentralising collective bargaining, deregulating parts of employment law, allowing the employment of workers on casual contracts and fixed-term contracts in place of indeterminate employment contracts, extension of the working week, What does that mean? Unemployment over 20%, youth unemployment 50%, tens of thousands of bankruptcies of small firms, and lack of growth leading to further cuts. So the process has become self-reinforcing. Demand has been sucked out of the economy by these changes. So there's no growth, or very little growth. There may be some effect on nominal wages. Whether this leads to effect on real wages depends upon the impact on productivity, and that's unclear. We know there are significant impacts on public health, including a large increase in suicides and a large increase in the dependence of the population as a whole on emergency medical attention as the Greek National Health Service is dismantled. So these are the real effects of the austerity programme on one member state. And of course, this has gone further in Greece than in the other member states who might be subject to the same process. But of course, if the Greek model is followed elsewhere, this particular programme will be rolled out for other Eurozone states. It's a consequence, to some limited degree, of Greece's own internal economic management, but to a much greater degree, it's a consequence of the policies imposed by the Troika since 2010. Now, within all this, of course, there's a huge debate about whether the ECB can act to save the euro, and they do. They begin from a very early stage buying bonds on secondary markets, the SNP programme from May 2010. They're buying Greek debt on the secondary market, so this essentially means that the ECB is not buying Greek bonds directly. It's not buying bonds directly from the Greek government, but it's buying them from banks who bought them from the Greek government on the so-called secondary market. And it's not just Greece. This has been extended to other countries. Not just that, the so-called LTRO program is basically transferring liquidity to the banks directly. So partly it's bond buying on the secondary markets, partly this 1,000 billion euro program of supporting the banks in the member states. And then finally, the outright market transactions program, which is essentially an extension of the earlier bond buying program. But really the big difference now is an open-ended commitment from the ECB to engage in the bond markets, secondary bond markets, to do a number of things. Essentially, purchases on the secondary bond market drive down interest rates in the country concerned, but may also deal with market speculation. Essentially, speculators betting against the euro, betting against or in favour of Spanish default, for example, are likely to lose their bet if the ECB makes this open-ended commitment. It may never have to do this, but saying it will do it has already had a very substantial effect on Spanish borrowing and has stabilised the situation for the time being in Spain and Italy. This is Mario Draghi's statement in July 2012. Now, had the ECB not done this, it's highly unlikely that the Eurozone would have at least stabilised to the point that it has. There would have been further speculation against the euro. So in a sense, this has solved, at least for the time being, the so-called existential crisis of the European Union. The euro has been preserved and saved by the bank's action. Now, as we've already heard and as you know, some aspects of this action may be questionable from a legal point of view. And this is one of the questions which the court indirectly addresses in the Pringle case. Let me just skip over this, because I think it's well known that alongside the bank's action, there's the wider changes to fiscal and macroeconomic policy. What does the court do in the Pringle judgment? Well, as we've heard, essentially it confirms the legality of Article 1363 TFEU and the ESM Treaty on the grounds that the ESMT does not interfere with the Union's exclusive competence in the area of monetary policy. So monetary policy, the court says, is concerned with price stability. This is essentially what the ECB is tasked with doing, or was tasked with doing, by the Maastricht Treaty and the Stability and Growth Pact. The ESM, on the other hand, is concerned with ensuring the stability of the entire euro area, its financial stability, and also its wider economic stability. Now, as Marcus has already said, this is a very fine legal distinction. This distinction between monetary policy and economic policy is highly formalistic. You might say it's innovative or inventive to draw this distinction, and I would agree. I think they had to do this. And of course, in one sense, they're right, but it does depend upon a rather formal reading of the TFEU. The other aspect of the court's judgment, which is tremendously important, of course, which Marcus has already mentioned, is that member states must, of course, comply with EU law when establishing the ESM, and the institutions must in future comply with EU law when operating within the ESM. So when the ECB and the Commission perform their functions within the ESMT, they must comply with EU law. And this is all right, we're told, because the ESM allows financial assistance to a debtor state only on terms of strict conditionality. Again, this refers back to Article 1363, of course.
So we're being told that this structure is legal under EU law only if the action is taken where it's indispensable to preserving the financial security of the Eurozone and strict conditionality is met, and in practice that will mean a structural adjustment programme of changes to social policy and labour law along the lines of what's already happened in Greece, although hopefully not so extreme. So really the court is doing a number of things. Obviously the court has to preserve the ESM, because the ESM is critical to maintaining the euro and to dealing with the issue of the eurozone's and the EU's existential crisis. This is potentially a crisis of the sort that could undermine the EU as a whole. If the euro were to collapse, it is plausible to see a scenario in which the EU itself begins to disintegrate. Okay. So this has to be done at one level. It's not at all surprising that the court decided as it did in the Pringle case. But of even more significance, I think, going forward, because that wasn't at all a surprise, what is perhaps surprising is a very strong link to conditionality in the court's judgment. And going forward, that's highly significant. So here we see in paragraph 111 of the court's judgment the reference to the need to ensure strict conditionality. And there are a number of references to the purpose of Article 125 being to maintain market discipline over the Eurozone states. The word discipline is used, and from time to time there are also references to the true functioning of the market as a foundation for Article 125. And this, of course, is to do with the so-called moral hazard problem implicit in the design of the Eurozone. The idea being that without something like Article 125 and the various no bailout clauses within the TFEU, a member state would be tempted to run up a huge fiscal deficit and transfer the cost to other members of the Eurozone area who had fiscal surpluses. So this, if you like, is the idea that strict conditionality is needed to avoid the moral hazard problem. But this, of course, really addresses the preventive part of the Stability and Growth Pact, how not to get into the mess in the first place. It doesn't address the emergency part of this process, how to deal with a crisis once you're in it. Now, the ECB is dealing with that crisis, now that we're in it, in a certain way. But what the court is saying here about conditionality applies not just to the preventive stage, but to the emergency remedial stage. In future, the idea is, I think, that the ECB can only act if it's following the principle of strict conditionality. Right. Now, what do we make of that? I think this is the really critical issue going forward. The Commission and the ECB must act in accordance with EU law. They must enforce strict conditionality. But this, of course, has a number of implications. I think the idea is presumably to tie the hands of the ECB, not that its hands need any tying at the moment, that the ECB would do this anyway, but the court is essentially saying going forward that the emerging economic constitution of the EU embeds this principle of moral hazard avoidance or strict conditionality on a long-term basis going forward, and that's bound to have some implications. Now, as already mentioned, the other impact of Pringle is to say, because the ESM is outside the mainstream of EU law, one cannot use the CFREU, for example, to question the application of the strict principle of conditionality. So it's not possible to use, for example, the social policy provisions, if one can call them that, of the CFREU relating to, for example, wage protection, unfair dismissal protection, and the right to strike. Article 28 of the CFREU respects collective labour rights. It's not possible to use those to challenge the process of imposing strict labour law conditionality on the member states. It seems, anyway. It's possible to argue that the court has maybe left a chink of light open here by saying that in future, the Commission and the ECB and other EU institutions, when acting under the ESM treaty, must comply with general EU law. So maybe that is a way to bring the Charter back in. Although, frankly, I don't think at the moment the court is prepared to listen to an argument, or even to hear it, to the effect that the conditionality process may be contrary to the social policy parts of the treaty, or in particular the Charter. The court has shown no willingness to go down that path. So I think that saying that there's only a chink of light there, again, doesn't really help us. But it's possible that some future point, this ambiguity might be open a bit wider. But for the time being, I think the very clear message is you can't go down this path. Well, what next? So this really depends on what we think will happen to the European economy and to its emerging economic constitution in the coming months. Now, the argument, I think, in favour of Pringle and in favour of it as a legal judgment is that the innovativeness, if one can call it that, the creativeness shown by the court in Pringle, has allowed the economic constitution of the EU to evolve to deal with the emergency situation that the Union finds itself in. The court has had to take a stance on the relationship between monetary policy and economic policy, which has given the EU institutions critical flexibility that they need to deal with the crisis. The structure of the single currency post Maastricht was designed to stop a crisis like this ever occurring. That was a preventive dimension of the Stability and Growth Pact. Well, unfortunately, the crisis has occurred, in part thanks to the over-rigid design of the single currency itself, but of course thanks also to other factors beyond the control of the EU, global financial recession. Now, given that we're in this crisis, the court had to, I think, allow the EU constitution to evolve to provide the ECB with the power to deal with this, because only the ECB could really deal with it. Only the ECB can deal with this, because only a central bank of any entity, whether it's a nation state or something like the EU, whatever that is, some sort of nascent confederation, only the central bank can deal with this problem in the way the ECB has. So to that extent, the Pringle judgment is very important and absolutely critical economically and legally, and should be applauded. The flexibility shown by the court should be absolutely applauded. And I'm not one of those who would say, in some way, the rule of law has been suspended inside the EU for the past 2 years. I think it's absolutely wrong. The constitution has to evolve, and the court should be applauded for taking that step. But of course, the problem going forward is the idea that strict conditionality is the only basis upon which the ECB can act. Now, this, I think, is far too inflexible. The bond buying programme will stabilise the euro in the short run, but the fundamental underlying problem is that there's no growth at all in the periphery states. Very little, anyway. And of course, this will have knock-on effects on the core states in due course, because there's a lot of intra-EU trade going on. Yes, Germany, for example, exports a certain amount to China and is dependent on world markets for its export performance. But also German companies export a great deal to the rest of the EU. And in a sense, when German banks and French banks are lending to both governments and other banks in the peripheral, in the indebted states, they're effectively making it possible for German companies to sell their products in those states and for German workers to keep their jobs. It's not a completely closed system, but what the bank does to a large extent remains within the Eurozone area for everybody's benefit. So the issue is not, is the bank doing something that's fundamentally economically wrong? The question is, can we release some of the flows which have to be released between the North and the South to make the Eurozone as an area more stable? And the problem, of course, with strict conditionality is it sucks demand out of the peripheral, the indebted states, and the TSCG is just designed to lock that in forever, as Angela Merkel said, for eternity. Right, okay. Now, there's obviously a danger that there'll just be no more growth, which is a problem, but also a race to the bottom in labour and social standards. That immediately poses a political problem. Political instability arises from the type of austerity measures which have been introduced in Greece. We can see already a political reaction in Italy, which has put in doubt, really, the willingness of national electorates to vote for parties maintaining austerity policies. So this is a fundamental conundrum now facing the ECB. In a crisis, the central bank has to act to save capitalism. Polanyi said, factory legislation and social laws were required to protect the human person against the so-called self-regulating market. The idea that the market regulates itself is entirely destructive of human well-being. But also, Polanyi said, the central banking system and the management of the monetary system are needed to keep manufacturers and other productive enterprises safe. Not only human beings, but the organisation of capitalist production itself has to be sheltered from the devastating effects of a self-regulating market. And the ECB for the past year has just been doing what other central banks do. In a crisis, the central bank and the government are effectively in a mutual defence pact, where the central bank has to support the government by buying its debt, either directly or indirectly, and the government subsidises the banking sector, as we've seen in the UK, through quantitative easing. This is a mutual defence pact, which of course involves a tautology, or to some degree a circularity. It appears as if the central bank is just printing money, but again, this is a question of flows, so not stocks. Okay, it's a question of flows rather than creating something new which didn't previously exist. And unless there's this flexibility to deal with a crisis, both the central bank and the government face a very bleak future. Now, the problem is, of course, we don't have that symmetrical relationship between a government and a central bank inside the EU. We have the ECB and we have the Eurozone member state government still. We don't have this symmetrical relationship, and the ECB is apparently prevented from doing some things by the Maastricht Treaty structure, which we've inherited from that time. Now, of course, the ESM, if it gets a banking license, which it will, can borrow directly from the bank. And this will, of course, mean the bank is, in effect, then, almost buying bonds on the primary market, which it's not supposed to do. But again, this may be critical for dealing with the short-term problem. Longer term, in a crisis like this, what we've really seen is private sector debt transferred to the public sector, because only the government can assume these debts. The government is, in a sense, the risk bearer of last resort. If everything else fails in the private sector, the government has to come in, and that's what's happened. As Minsky predicted in the mid-1980s, in a financial crisis of the kind he argued was inevitable, the central bank must intervene to shore up liquidity. This does, of course, create a moral hazard problem. Big government has to come in to assume responsibility for the macroeconomy and for financial stabilisation. And the EU doesn't have a big government. This is a critical problem going forward. So what I suggest will happen, but should happen, but probably will happen eventually, is we will see a shift in policy, maybe something approaching a European New Deal, because we know from history that in the end, austerity can't deal with a fundamental economic crisis of this sort. And the crisis, unfortunately for the euro, will resume fairly shortly, unless the markets think economic growth can be restored. So even more flexibility than the Pringle case shows has to be there on the part of the EU institutions going forward to deal with the existential crisis. And it's that serious. The euro won't survive unless some more flexible means to save it is found. So the ECB should become formally a lender of last resort to counter this self-fulfilling market speculation which has been going on. So once the ESM can borrow directly from it, then more or less that will have happened. But I think also monetary policy, which is very strict, does need to be balanced by a growth-orientated economic policy. Now, of course, this has been much debated and was debated in the 1990s at the time of the Stability and Growth Pact. It was called the Stability and Growth Pact. Okay, there may have been more stability than growth, but growth has never been entirely off the EU agenda. Now, here's a really interesting possibility. The Pringle case makes this easier, not more difficult. So, on one hand, yes, I fully take the point. What Pringle did was to say some of these institutions are to one side from EU law. They appear to be outside the structure of EU law, and there's a lack of democratic accountability. But actually, a growth-orientated economic policy is made easier by this formal distinction between monetary and economic policy. Because really, there's leeway now to say that a growth-orientated economic policy is separate from a price stability-orientated monetary policy. Now, of course, in practice, they're related. They're bound to affect one another. But I think legally, constitutionally, again, a window has been opened here. Thirdly, there should be a counter-cyclical fiscal policy. Now, of course, requiring fiscal surpluses in a period of growth is right. This is the preventive aspect of the SGP. But requiring fiscal surpluses in a recession is sure to be counterproductive. Again, we know this from the lessons of history. The Treaty on Stability, Coordination and Growth, the TSCG, is a dead letter at the moment. It can't be enforced. It could be enforced in maybe 10 or 20 years' time when growth resumes, or maybe less than that. But it's a dead letter for the time being, because to actually make it work would worsen the crisis immediately. There has to be some element of counter-cyclical fiscal policy here, or else growth simply won't resume. There also has to be financial re-regulation to curb private sector moral hazard. We're getting that. There has also to be control of regulatory competition in fiscal law and social policy to avoid a race to the bottom. Now, what's interesting is that we don't need any new powers for this. We don't need new powers. We don't need a new EU treaty to re-regulate the private sector financial market institutions. We don't need, I think, a new treaty to deal with social policy issues. We can pass more directives if there's political agreement. We don't need a treaty revision to get social policy going. Treaty revisions, again, may help for fiscal policy, but again, there's a lot the EU can already do to deal with a race to the bottom in fiscal law. The fact that the Treaty on Stability, Coordination and Growth is not part of EU law, again, may be helpful. if we're moving forward here to a more growth-orientated EU policy. I said it's like a dead letter, and maybe it would be marginalised, if not completely put to one side. It's useful that it's not part of EU law. Finally, transnational wage determination. Again, we don't need a new provision for that. Article 152 TFEU, the social dialogue provision, can work. And existing funds can provide a basis for what's clearly needed, a targeted infrastructure investment programme. So how would the court respond if we ended up with a European New Deal? Well, we know that the court recently has been very neoliberal in its approach to economic policy issues. This is the Viking and Laval litigation. And probably the court would be neoliberal again if it was called upon to decide on these issues. And then we would see a clash of the kind we saw in the 1930s in the United States, when the Supreme Court for several years tried to block Roosevelt's New Deal measure. So here's a cartoon from the 1930s showing Roosevelt trying to rescue the American economy and pull it out of the sea. The Supreme Court said that was illegal, and he says, I've got to push you back in. So the court was rendering void lots of legislation. AAA refers to the Agricultural Adjustment Act, not to AAA rating, but there we are. In the end, the court only backed down when Roosevelt threatened to pack it with new members. So I think this may well be the next exciting phase of the Euro crisis. Thank you.